Hello and welcome to Getting Goosebumps, the weekly podcast exploring the business of storytelling, where I interview many of the world's greatest marketers and storytellers to share their insights and ideas of how to put emotion into marketing. Well, hello and welcome to another show, everybody. Today, I'm really excited to be joined by Scott Stratton, CEO, founder of marketing agency Unmarketing, author and also an author of several incredible books. He's a fantastic speaker, very talented guy, lots of other things I could talk about, but I'll let him do the talking. Hello, Scott.
Oh, no pressure at all. Thank you for that intro. It's a funny thing is when I do, all I do is keynotes at conferences nowadays, and when the person introduces me and says, he's the funniest speaker I've ever seen, you're just like, no. You're supposed to say he's the most bland or dry speaker. Then I can, if you set expectations low, you can always go above them.
Oh, well, no pressure then, as you say. Scott, I've seen you talk, and you've got quite an interesting take on, as a marketer, quite an interesting take on marketing. Can you just start by explaining your principle of unmarketing?
Well, unmarketing came about 12 years ago, and I was the national sales training manager for a packaging company. And most of the marketing I saw taught back then and being done back then, even sales, was all about this push and pray format. It was, you know, push your message out in front of as many people as possible and you pray if a few people would react to it. And with no regard or thought for any collateral marketing damage you would create. You know, you didn't care about the flyers that people didn't want or the cold calls people didn't want to answer, whatever. As long as you got your sale eventually, that's all you cared about. And it really came to a head for me when I was in a friend's office and we were chatting and the phone rang and it was a cold call. And he started berating the guy of wasting his time and, you know, find a better way to do things and all this stuff. And we got off the phone and we kind of, you know, talked back and forth and laughed about it. And then he looked at me and said, okay, Scott, you have to go. I have to do my calls for the day. I just looked at him and I said, well, we just spent 20 minutes talking about how ridiculous it is. And he said to me, well, yeah, but I sell something people need. And I'm like, and that was, as we say, the tipping point for me, which was we're hypocritical marketers. We market the way we hate being marketed to. And I thought there's got to be a different way, a better way. And for the world that enjoys that blasting the message out, just, you know, endless budgets and endless annoyances. And the people who like to do cold calling, I call those people psychopaths. But there's the whole other part of the world that isn't naturally interruptive, that isn't naturally the one who wants to bully their way into a sale. And that's where I realized where my sweet spot was, which is unmarketing. Now, many people try to call me out on it, and I'm the first to admit unmarketing is marketing. It's just marketing better. It's marketing, you know, with your community. It's marketing and getting in front of them for the right reasons. With this is back in the day when the term content marketing didn't exist. Back in the day when social media wasn't a term. We just called it talking. And I'm all about marketing with your grain instead of against your grain. If it doesn't feel natural, it's really tough to get good at something you're terrible at. I can make somebody from good to great at something, but being really poor at something is not something. I don't really want to strengthen my weaknesses. I want to enhance my strengths. And a lot of people have a natural marketing ability, whether that's writing, whether that's networking, whether that's being online and connecting with people, whether that's doing a talk or books. I think we all have a natural part in ourselves to do certain things, and we just define that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've already ruined my second question because I was going to call you out on that whole unmarketing thing. But one thing you do say is stop marketing and start engaging, which, given your introduction, I totally agree with. It's just about doing it better, I guess. But you also, in a lot of your talks, you, I think, quite deliberately blur the line between customer service and social media engagement. In your eyes, is it the same thing? And, you know, is great marketing blurred with great customer service?
100%. That's the thing. We tend to think that companies are run in silos, sales, marketing, accounting, finance, human resources, personnel, operations. And what we don't realize is our brand isn't viewed in silos. Our brand is viewed as a whole. And, you know, I've always said the best marketing you can do is create a great product or service and have great customer service that goes with that. Because the stories we tell about our bad brand experience will always spread farther and faster and longer than any ad campaign, and they don't cost anything. And that's the strongest message we have. So when I say a brand to somebody, pick an airline, pick any airline in the world. Give me an airline where you are right now. Give me one of the airline brands.
Virgin Atlantic.
Okay, so if you say Virgin Atlantic, and whatever somebody says after that, that's the brand to that individual consumer. But it's the thing is, what happens if I had a bad flight last week? Then that's the brand to me. And the brand, the recency effect of these brands is a big thing we're not noticing, that we can spend all the money in the world. We can spend the fanciest commercials. We can have Richard Branson skydiving on top of the plane and then skydiving off the plane. But if you had poor service on your last flight, all that commercial does is anger you. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like, well, Richard Branson could skydive onto a plane, but I couldn't get a frickin' bag of pretzels to kill myself, you know, on this flight. So that's what I mean is psychologists say when we see a brand, when we see a logo, we think of two things. We think of our most extreme experience with them, good or bad, and our most recent experience with them, good or bad, or one we've heard. And that's where service is so much part of that. And that's when social media jumps into that world, where to me, social media isn't a sales and marketing platform in a classical sense. It's a sales and marketing and branding platform in a sense of a customer service side of things. If that's where our customers are going and complaining, that's where our brand really gets to evolve and move into what it actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk about immediacy as well, don't you? So from a customer experience point of view, it's not just the job of the guys monitoring the social channels to create that great experience. Sometimes it's their job to rectify a problem in the real world, because that tends to be the first place a lot of us go to now to complain, right?
It's rectifying in the real world in real time, mm-hmm. where the expectation of a reply on a platform like Twitter is almost as high, if not higher sometimes, than an email to a brand or even a phone call, where people say, and customers and brands say, well, we don't use Twitter. Well, the customer doesn't care. You know, that's where they're complaining. Now, it's your choice whether or not you want to resolve it. And do something about it, but it can't be, you know, you can't have a Twitter account occasionally. You know, it's like a real-time game being played by a part-time player. It doesn't work very well. And sometimes, if you think about anybody listening right now, not as a business person, but as a consumer, you realize that the speed at which somebody gets back to you is sometimes paramount to what they say back to you. If you come out and you complain, or you go all caps on Twitter about something, and they write back to you and say, hey, you know, we're sorry about that. Let's see what we can do. That does more for you than somebody replying 3 days later when you've had time to steam about it and get even angrier. And we also don't understand that a tweet or even a phone call or an email to our brand, that's almost the last resort. People don't usually actually, we're actually a fairly decent society, and we don't just try to out brands for attention. It's usually a last resort. We've come to a manager, we've come to a salesperson, we've come to some customer service, and they just haven't done anything about it. This whole kind of complacency, this whole kind of thing of just kind of, well, too bad. But now we have this public forum where we have equal footing as consumers, which is why I love it. I love the fact that we can actually stand up and say, this is not right. This is what I paid for, and I'm not getting it. And I've waited my whole life for a place like this.
Absolutely. And I remember once I complained about a brand on Twitter, and they came back really quickly. And that second where you see the notification where the brand's come back to you, but you haven't read the tweet yet, that came in. I thought, oh, great, they've responded. I opened it up, and the tweet read, can you please log your complaint on Facebook because we don't monitor. I was like, wow, okay. So that's amazing.
That's the worst. And we actually wrote about this. The chapter was called Never Tell a Customer They're Standing in the Wrong Line.
Yeah.
Right, which is my complaints here. And it's so people are like, yeah, we have a Twitter corporate account. It redirects people to, you know, the please go to this web form, please call our call center, please go to Facebook. You're like, look, I've been standing in this line waiting. This is how I want to communicate. And I get it. Brands sometimes have a customer service aspect can't scale, where they're a smaller company, they don't have the staff or the resources, and they have to try to funnel all the responses into one place. I get it. I understand. But you have an opportunity with places like Twitter and Facebook where it's publicized customer service. You get to show the world, not just the complainant, that you actually care. If somebody emails customer service, if they phone, it's one-to-one service. But if it's Facebook or Twitter or any other online platform, it's one to everyone. And there's an exponential benefit to that for showing that you back your products, you back your word, that you're going to do something about it.
Absolutely. You know, you have to respond, don't you? Otherwise, it exponentially gets worse, like you said. But also, if you demonstrate in a public space that you deal with a problem quickly, That can also have a positive effect with everybody watching that problem unfold, I guess, Connor.
That's really the whole, we talk about, there's a lot of trendy stuff now to talk about brands, you know, like, well, storytelling, right? We tell our story and I'm like, we don't write the story. You know, we provide part of the narrative, but it's the people watching that write the stories. It's the people that are involved, the customer we're talking to, they write that story. The most compelling story is the one that somebody else tells about you,
yeah,
not your own kind of written one. And that is a big part of it. I had an experience myself with, I bought two of our kids overpriced Beats by Dre headphones. And because, you know, if I can't provide them a good education at school, at least they can look good at school when they go. And one of the headbands snapped. And these are $300 headphones. And I just threw up my mouth saying that I bought $300 headphones for my children. But it shattered, and I went and looked it up, and it had to be apparently a common problem, and I tweeted about it. And the Beats by Dre support in Canada, which is where we are, got back to me immediately, and they said, can we please follow us so we can direct message, because there's, you know, customer information, and I get it. They were great. I went in there, and I had to fill something out because it was a warranty issue, but they had pre-filled in the form for me using my information existing on Twitter already and said, brilliant, we're sorry to send you over here, but it helps track the warranty. So even if they sent me off-site, even if I, quote, lined up in the wrong line, they did the work for me. And then they backed it up, and then we got a replacement set, no problem, which took my view of a brand that I didn't want to be part of in the first place, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It made me realize, you know what? Do they have the best quality headphones in the world? No. Do they have the nicest looking? Well, to the kids, sure. But do they back up their product? And the answer was yes.
That really is, you know, and that's a story you're telling me now, to our audience. And that's, you know, you're a brand ambassador, and it started with something going wrong, which is phenomenal. I love your way of looking at it, like, never ask a customer to stand in the wrong line. The good thing about being British is there's no such thing as a wrong line. We'll queue up for anything. But I've heard you define social media as your three C's, okay? Conversation, community, customer service. So I think we've talked about that a little bit now, and we'll probably come back to it as well. What's your advice to marketers listening to this, thinking, well, that's all very well and good philosophically, but I have KPIs, I've got things I need to achieve on my marketing desk. My boss wants more leads and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. What's your advice to those guys? Is it just to be aware of the principles whilst working towards KPIs? Or, you know, is it a completely different approach? What's your advice?
Yeah, if you're looking for the KPIs in your marketing, and we're talking about social media, then you need to stop being in social media. It's not for that. It doesn't work. It's terrible. It's spam has a better retention rate. I'm not even being flippant. I'm being absolutely, this is coming from a guy who's tweeted 112,000 times. All manually, all with my two thumbs. Uh-huh. And so I've done the work for you all listening right now. And so you don't have to. And I've come to the conclusion that social is a terrible classical sales and marketing platform, meaning driving leads, driving business. What it is good for is the three C's I said, for community, for customer service, for conversation. And there, to me, social media shouldn't even be under the umbrella of marketing in a company. It's got to be under, whether it's a customer evangelist position, a customer experience, customer service. That is truly where something like Twitter resides. Now, does that mean you shouldn't be doing a Facebook post in the marketing department under your brand page? No. But I think the Facebook brand pages could use a little less marketing and a little more stories, a little more content, you know, community curation than anything else. We've proven time and time again that people don't want to see just generic ads and messages like that that were in the old. Social media is not a place to send old crappy ads, you know, that are no longer working, let's say in print. Let's just shove them down this funnel now. It's terrible. I'm a marketer, but I'm also a social media evangelist. I love community. And what happens in every platform there is in the history of human beings is they go great, and then marketers come along and screw them up.
Well, yeah, marketers ruin everything. A few people have tried to coin that one, and you know, and I agree. We rinse every sort of last ROI we can out of every platform. That's what marketers have traditionally done. But there will be people listening to this saying, "Come on, Scott, you must be crazy, because I am a professional marketer. I only use social media, and I'm growing my business. I'm growing my department. I'm hitting my numbers." Are you looking at this from a, if you have great conversation, you know, sales and opportunities will come to you? Is that the sort of philosophy?
Well, I think somewhat. I don't want to get to the point where it's kind of let's all hold the hands and sing "We Are the World" or anything like that, where it's just about hugs and retweets and likes. But the problem is when people say I'm meeting my numbers, you know, we have to be careful that they're not vanity metrics. Uh-huh. They're not metrics like just shares or just retweets or just follows. That there's an impact to the brand equity out there, that there's a difference in the brand perception out there. And we need to understand that sometimes that those numbers are made up. They're just made up. And they make us feel good. I can get you a million views if you want on a video. I can get you a million retweets on something. I can just buy them. You know, I can get them done if you want the vanity of it. But when somebody says, like for myself, I have 177,000 followers on Twitter. So let's just, for argument's sake, say I have 100,000 and I send a tweet with your brand's chosen hashtag of the week and I tweet it out once. They say that tweet metric is it's reached 100,000 people. And that's a flat out lie. It's a flat out lie. And they know it. And you know it listening right now, that metric is vanity. It's an old PR trick. It's like the magazine pass-along metric. You know, you have 10,000 subscribers with a times 5 pass-along, therefore you reach 50,000 people. This is worse, because with Twitter, 10% of 10% of 10%, we call it fractional reaction. 10% of people are online at any given time. 10% of those may see your tweet, and you know, 10% of those may react to it. So it's really, really scaled down, because social is not about, and this is how I compare it. It's like a funnel. You know, I'm an old school sales and marketing guy. So the funnel works where, in classical sense of a funnel, when I, the vendor or brand, send out a message to my funnel, they have to react to it. A phone call, you answer it, you don't answer it. You listen to a voicemail, you don't. Mm-hmm. Direct mail, I read it, I recycle it, I throw it away, I act on it. An email, read it, open it, reply, delete, spam. But the receiver, my target, my lead, has to react to it. And in social media, you don't. If you follow me on Twitter and I send out a tweet, you don't have to decide, do I read it, retweet it, reply, delete, follow, unfollow, because 100,000 people won't see it. 500 people may see it. Mm-hmm. And that's not a funnel to me. That's a sieve. It's very, very fractional. So the numbers, hey, I make a living off of having numbers in my bio that don't make anything. 177,000 followers, one of the top 5 social media influencers in the world by Forbes.com. And that and $5 gets me a coffee somewhere. You know, that metric means nothing.
Yeah.
But I live in a world that vanity metrics count on.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that's where marketers get hung up on metrics which don't add value. I mean, and obviously, the difference between a retweet and all the rest of it compared to a lead that turns into business, that's undeniable. But I think...
But I will give it to marketers. Is there a use of social? Of course.
Yeah.
There's a power to it. But to me, the power in social is leveraging people who have the platforms themselves.
Yeah.
It's working with influencers. It's working on campaigns. So instead of the brand trying to be the cool person that shows up, sorry, the uncool person showing up at the high school or the party saying, "What's up, dudes? You know, hey, we're part of the party too." Then you work with people who have influence in your marketplace. But that takes time, that takes research, and it's harder than writing a tweet.
Oh, so, absolutely. And you know, I guess it comes back to being a good conversationalist then.
Oh, huge. And that's a lost art form. The ability to not only talk with people, but also have a banter back and forth. And people forget that I'm a brand. You know, Unmarketing is a brand that I've built originally starting through, you know, as a big platform through Twitter. But I worked it. In January 2009, I decided to give Twitter my all and try it for 30 days and see if there was an effect to it. And if it didn't, I would have bailed. But if it did, I would stick around. And I sent 7,000 tweets that month.
Really? In 1 month?
Yeah, but 80% of them were replies.
Okay.
So they're conversations. They're going back and forth. They're not just me tweeting about my shoes or my breakfast or something. They're actually conversations. But I'm having 100 conversations at once. And I had 1,200 followers to start that month. And at the end, I had 10,000. And I realized there's momentum here. There's community here. There's conversation here. And I went on to, I never stopped. And I haven't stopped since. But the point was the reply ratio. It was 8-1, 9-1 when it came to just general tweets. And to me, we called it social currency. You got to invest your social currency in a platform. When brands come in and just want to buy their way into it, they'll buy sponsored Instagram posts. They'll do all these type of things. Say, you know, hey, you know, it's back to that push and pray. You know, let's just blast this stuff out of here in this community. When back in the day, when we had social media was just forums and message boards, if a brand tried to come in and do that, they would have gotten beaten down so quick they wouldn't even seen it coming.
Yeah, absolutely.
But now that Twitter and Facebook are around, they just think they can buy their way into it. That's, I don't think it's the time or the place for it.
Yeah, I mean, that brings us nicely on to, you know, the power of storytelling right now. And I've seen you talk a few times, Scott, and you've got a lovely way of telling stories to make your point. And obviously, we're talking about being a conversationalist. You know, you really do make your point really well. In fact, you know, Louis C.K. talks about death, sex, and how he secretly hates his kids. I think the only difference between you and him is that, you know, you're talking about social media and tech failures from the perspective of customers. You do have a way of telling a story. You engage and you use comedy in a very powerful way. Now, not everybody can do that. So we agree that the a great digital currency online is being a conversationalist, the art of conversation, going back to basic principles of, you know, maybe actually, like Ted Rubin just a week back was talking about, you see, Brian, people don't call anybody anymore, blah, 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 and going back to those principles. What's your advice on approaching your brand story or telling great stories or engaging within stories when your audience and your community speak to you and ask questions and that kind of stuff? What's the best way to approach that?
I think first that storytelling can't be forced. You know, I think that there's certainly a natural ability to that, whether it's the problem we get into when it comes to being part of a narrative or a conversation is that, you know, in real time, you have to have somebody who's good at that. And trying to force your way into a story isn't always the best move. Now, if you have somebody who's good or talented or communicates very naturally, then it's good. The problem is brands get very scared. Mm-hmm. They want to write the narrative and you read the script. And that's really how a lot of brands think storytelling is. It's the old classical PR thing. When PR, you know, they think it stands, you know, it's not public relations anymore. It's you know, press release. Mm-hmm. That's what PR stands for them. So there's a very scary thing of allowing the narrative to go out there and be open. And for me, it's just one of my, I'm lucky that I have an ability to tell stories. And that's my job. I'm a professional storyteller. Mm-hmm. Really, that's what I do. But one of the most important things to me and a backbone of Unmarketing and Unselling is that it's the ability, like I said earlier, to create the content within which the story gets told. That if you're good at what you do, you try to tell everybody. If you're great at what you do, everybody tells everybody else for you.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah.
Right? You don't have to do it. And the problem is, an example, we're doing a webinar later on today, and it's an open Q&A thing. So we ask people to send in questions, and we'll answer them for them. And the person said, and this should really give you a good idea of where I'm going with my whole brand storytelling, is that the person said, any tips on networking? We have a story and we really want people to know about it. Like, what? No, that's not the, what? It's like meeting a person. They're like, how you doing? I'm Scott. And they're like, hey, I'm Jeff. Here's my story. Like, I didn't want your story, dude. I didn't want it. And so trying to force feed people that story is not, I don't think is necessarily the right way. Now, if a natural thing comes out of a conversation, then that's it. But, you know, at the end of the day, not everything's epic. Not everything is worthy of being told. Mm-hmm. But when somebody says, hey, did you go for dinner here at this place? And you said, you know what? Yeah, the food was a little bit undercooked, and the server came out and caught it and refused to accept that was acceptable to anybody and fixed it. That's a story. Mm-hmm. The reviews we see on websites, those are stories. You create that narrative to it. The problem is marketing isn't involved in it a lot of times. That's frontline people. And I think marketing's job is not trying to write the story. It's trying to prepare our writers. It's trying to prepare our frontline people to say, you're part of this narrative and we need to talk about it and how much you matter. Because it still is. Sales and marketing and finance are all up in their tower, in their ivory tower. And the front lines are the ones who get beaten down by the customers and the clients. And those frontline people have to realize they're much more important than they think in the grand scheme of our brand narrative. And sometimes that story gets told because of the influence of those frontline, lowest paid workers instead of us marketers.
Yeah, I think customer service departments probably are filled with stories that could be told, but they don't talk to the marketers, so they're not used or exploited, or you know, they're not in the arsenal as much as they possibly could be.
Because they don't talk at all.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is it's a separate cost center to them. They don't talk, they don't meet. You know, when was the last time marketing had a meeting with, think about it, anybody listening right now, when was the last time a marketing department met with customer service?
Oh, absolutely. And the HR department, all the rest of it. I was talking to Ted Rubin about this. I really hit upon something next. Ted Rubin went on for a while, actually, huge rant. And it's absolutely true, isn't it? But given we know that then, Scott, and there's a fundamental problem with creating sort of contrived stories that are always about the brand, because that's not conversation. That's just using the tools for the, right. You know, the sort of like Coca-Cola used in the 50s kind of thing. You know, it's contrived. How do you then strategically plan your marketing using social media or using digital means if we've got to wait for those stories to happen? Because surely your standpoint on contriving stories in the marketing department, or planning events in order to capture them on video to use in marketing, surely that goes against the principles you've just been talking about, right?
It does, but there's a difference between stories and content. You know, stories are the things that people tell, but you can create brand content that can then be shared on those platforms and be shared by other people. Now, I think of a story as somebody say, I got to tell you this, and here's a story, and this is where that story comes out. It can be done a person to person and voice or in video, but it really is a narrative that we don't actually control. Content, on the other hand, can be done, where that means it's your, let's say it's your blog. Let's say it's a post about, you know, you are, maybe you're Virgin Airlines, and maybe, you know, you'll do a blog post about the ways to, you know, make air travel better for you, you know, traveling, whether it means to, changing time zones, should I be changing my sleep patterns, like helpful things like that, content that actually works. Whether it's, you know, again, it could be funny, it could be helpful, it could be useful, but the content you create is fine. That's not a story necessarily. It's not a narrative necessarily, but it's a post, and it can do. You can do a, you know, maybe you're jumping on Periscope and you're going to give a behind the scenes look at something. Well, there's an example of British Columbia, a province on the West Coast here in Canada, did a Periscope, you know, live streaming a video of a beekeeper there. It was Tourism BC, and they did a beekeeper and had 4 million bees there. And it was, she's just holding their phone right there, and they're talking with the bees all over them and jumping on the camera. And it was awesome. and you know, that wasn't really, that's not scripted. You can't script anything with 4 million bees around you. But it was a great real piece of content that we shared and spread. And it wasn't one of those things that was overthought or overdone, but it was using the medium properly.
So is the purpose of content to spark conversations and stories? Is that the aim?
I think so. I think that's the biggest part about it. I think that if content doesn't spark a conversation, or, you know, at least something going on there, then it's not a very good piece of content.
Yeah. So how does that change the way lots of people listening to this, how does that change the way they approach content? Because I'll tell you now, Scott, I'm sure you'll agree, lots of people listening to this think, huh, I thought content was designed to have a relevant call to action at the end so I could just collect their data.
No, it's called a sales page. There's a difference between those two things.
Well, a lot of people produce blog posts to maybe talk about the principles of something, and then they want to give away a free ebook and that kind of stuff to get you into their marketing funnel. So you don't agree with that approach at all?
Well, I think there's time and place for it. And I think that I just don't think the be all and end all is going to be the conversion necessarily every time. I think having consistent quality content in front of your target market helps over a long period of time. Certainly when the ad industry used to say it took 7 to 9 exposures of an ad to somebody before they react to it. That stat, by the way, brought to you by the newspaper Ad Sellers of America. But the problem is, then what about 7 to 9 pieces of quality content being in front of people where they actually learn something from it, they gain something from it, and they share it? I think that's more effective necessarily. Now, mind you, a conversion on a page, a place to sign up for something, sure, of course. But the be all and end all isn't just that. It's like having that wall between the gatekeeper, between the content. So it's the difference of having the blog post and then at the end saying, by the way, if you want more content like this, grab this. We have a white paper right now you can sign up for. Yeah. Versus when you get to the page, it says sign up for this before you get access to the content. You know, it's two different hooks to it to me. And I think the former is better than the latter.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. But break it down for the marketers who are listening and probably leaning in and really intrigued. It's like, huh, it might be a little bit more to producing content after all. Given that we've said the purpose of content is to spark conversations and stories, how do you approach content? How do you approach producing content for a brand consistently and sometimes under pressure, a lot of marketers have to push something out every week.
Right.
How do you balance those things? And what can you do to stack the odds in your favor? So when somebody gets to the end, they're in the mindset, the frame of mind to say, I'm going to share this. I'm going to start a conversation about this. Is there any advice you can give to the audience?
Yeah, the consistency side of things is really a big kind of bone of contention for me, where that people say we have to, because there's some empirical rule somewhere that we have to blog weekly or daily or biweekly or whatever it's going to be, because that's what we were heard was the most optimum frequency. And I would always say at talks, you know, the best time to blog is when you have something compelling to say to your audience. And then if you don't, just don't. And then people would come up to me and say, that was a great point, Scott. So do you mean like every Tuesday? Is that a good day? Like, what did you listen to what I said? It's like, nobody has shared a brand blog post because it was Tuesday. You know, nobody said like, well, it's mediocre and it's self-serving, but it is Tuesday. It's a good day to share content. So let me share that. We spread emotion. My whole background with unmarketing and when I used to run the agency was viral marketing. It was people spreading stuff and why. And we always found through the 60 client projects we did and 60 million views of the videos, which back then was epic. It was, I only learned one thing. At the end of the day, the only result I had from all these things was people spread emotions. When you evoke emotion, when you have something compelling, now it doesn't mean that a person who sells widgets needs to make people cry with their content. That's one emotion, but there's anger, happy, sad, thought-provoking, interesting, all those things are still also emotions. That if I learn something, I find something's a really good story, then that, you know, we have to think outside that box a bit too. Sometimes it's like letting your customers come in and write their story. It's like there was a great, you know, I'm talking to you on Skype right now, and there was a Skype commercial last year or so that came out because of a customer story. That was two young women who both were born without half their right arm. And they, you know, it's growing up, it's a different thing to deal with. And they had found each other through the internet and talked on Skype for years. And Skype then filmed them meeting in person for the first time. And it was phenomenal. And like that was a commercial and it was a story. And like that was, our customers are our best storytellers. And we got to find that. You can have an employee that you don't realize in your warehouse that has a really compelling story. Sometimes you got to open up to listen to them. You got to open up to be able to hear them. Have an open dialogue with employees saying, we like to share our employees' stories because without them, we're not here. And that starts opening things up. And it's amazing what can come out of it. Now, back to the content consistency format. The problem is if Skype tried to do that every week because Tuesdays was optimal, it wouldn't work. My problem, I don't have it. Now, mind you, I blog once every year, maybe, because, partially lazy, but I really want my blog to be the the tip of the mountain, the very top, saying this is only the best stuff. And Facebook on marketing, I'll share when something gets me angry, which is usually daily, but I have no set thing for it. But we also do the Unpodcast, which is weekly. Uh-huh. But we've always said that we will never have frequency surpass quality. So if we don't have anything to talk about, then we wouldn't put a show out that week. Now, we've had 88 episodes so far. We haven't run out. Luckily, because we talk about terrible brand marketing moves, and there's never a shortage of stuff to talk about. But it's that there's two lines here where they intersect, the intersection of quality content and consistency. You should be as consistent as you can put out good stuff. So that could mean biweekly. That could be weekly, or it could be monthly, depending on what happens.
Well, just to clarify, I only share content on a Sunday, but
it's a good day. I hear it's a good day.
Yeah, oh, it's definitely the best day to share content. But if I'm hearing you right, Scott, is it that people are largely stuck in a rut and they lack the effort and they need a change in perspective with the content? Because, I mean, I guess it's easy to do if you're put under pressure to produce content every week, especially when you're of the mindset that it's got to be about you and it's got to be about your features and benefits and all the rest of it. Is that one of the biggest contributing factors to the reason that 99.999% of the world's marketers produce crap very consistently?
Very much so. I think it's just this forced content curation that makes us have this content apathy. That it's the point now is that you just don't care. And you notice that on places like Facebook with that average brand reach of 1-3% of your following on Facebook, it's seen. But you know what the unmarketing Facebook page, you know what the average reaches of every post is? About 68%.
Wow.
Why? Because I only post stuff that makes me furious and makes me go, it makes me angry, makes me say, you guys have to see that. That is my... And I produce it almost daily, but it evokes my emotion, so it should evoke their emotion, and that's it. That's a big, but mind you, I don't work for somebody.
Yeah, but that clearly comes across, though, doesn't it? when you post something.
Most brands can't do that, no, and I understand that. But that's where you have to find that middle ground, though. I think,
yeah,
but
find what works for you.
You have to make sure that at the end of the day, that the content is not about just you. It's about positioning yourselves as an authority in an industry, but that might not be just your story. What about profiling your own customers or clients and say what they're doing? Become the catalyst for that type of stuff. And it shows that, you know what? Like the most of the stuff I share on the unmarketing Facebook page has nothing to do with us. But because I'm confident in us and our brand that says, look, here's stuff going on this person's blog and this person's post and this person's Facebook page, because I'm not selfish as a brand to be able to say it's only our stuff and only you can only read our stuff. And I'm not ignorant enough to say that people only want to see our own crap all the time.
Yeah, but that does take a certain amount of confidence. But again, it's the perspective of, the pursuit of what you believe in rather than what you're peddling.
Correct.
And I think an effort is definitely a big part of it. And lots of marketers are working in a silo and they're on autopilot, which leads me on to probably the reason why QR codes kill kittens. I'm just going to hand the floor to you here, Scott, with no introduction here. Tell us why QR codes kill kittens.
You're going to get angry because this is how I get angry.
Go for it. Don't hold back.
There's a reason why the third book is called QR Codes Kill Kittens. Is I have no problem with QR codes, nor do I have a problem with kittens. I don't. My problem is the usage of them, especially in consumer-based marketing. QR codes have led a wonderful life.
The use of kittens or the use of QR codes?
Use of QR codes.
Just to clarify this, Scott.
Both. But they've been around for decades, and they've been used for concert tickets and airline boarding passes and hospital wristbands. They're just a robust barcode. But they're actionable. Like you scan them and they can take you somewhere. And a lot of times, most of the time, it's for a website somewhere. My problem is when marketers saw this is neat and went, let's break it, let's ruin it. And we started plastering them everywhere. Like I've seen QR codes on billboards off the side of the freeway, that they're on the, that I'm driving. I scan them with my phone. Like there's a there's a billboard in Ottawa, the fine capital city of my country, that is from our federal police, our national police force, and it says "Don't text and drive," and it has a QR code on it. it's entrapment. You know, like that's my problem, how it works. So you look at that and say, okay, well, you know, what else? I get emails with QR codes in them, and I'll just let everybody sit for a second and think about that and the idiocy of how that works. That I'm already on the phone. That my camera that would scan the QR code is on the other side of the phone. And I've seen people say to me, well, but some people get their email on their computer. I'm like, well, then I'm already on the computer. What could you possibly put in an email that would allow me to go to a specific page on the internet, like a link or something that would allow me to? I've seen them. I've seen them on websites. I've seen QR codes on websites. And I tell you, I've scanned them. And you know where they take you?
Go on.
Back to the website.
It's just wonderful. It's just wonderful, isn't it? You know, but I think, you know, it's technology for technology's sake, and, you know, it's a really good, you know, I asked you to sort of dive into that because it really does illustrate a point that we started with, Scott. You know, technology for technology's sake, marketing because you're told to, rather than thinking about the customer, and just putting the basic principles of empathy and communication first. Scott, I can't thank you enough for today. It's been an absolute pleasure. I do hope you'll come back. You've got a new book coming out, Unselling?
Yeah, it's already out. It came out a little while ago. Won Sales Book of the Year from CEO Read. So that and $10 will get me like a latte anywhere I go. Yeah, it's been out. It's our fourth book, and I've been real proud of it. It's the only business book with a blank cover. So, you know, take that, publishing world. You know.
Well, I'd love to have you back and maybe delve into the world of Unselling if you'll do me that pleasure. But for now, Scott, where can people find out more about you? And is there anything else you'd like to draw our attention to or leave us with?
Yeah, well, we love doing the Unpodcast, the business show for the Fed Up. It's myself and Allison, who's co-author of the books and the co-host of the show and my co-host in life. She's my wife and the better half in every sense of the imagination. So the show is pretty much me freaking out and her saying, relax, and here's a smart thought.
Brilliant.
For everybody else.
Fantastic. So we can just search for Unpodcasting.
Yeah, or go to unpodcast.com. We actually do a full video, 3-camera shoot in the studio as well. So it's a show, it's audio, it's video. So come on now.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again, Scott. It's been an absolute pleasure. Guys, that's it for another week. Please join me next time. Until then, take care. Goodbye. So that's it for another week. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. If you did, please feel free to subscribe or even check out our Getting Goosebumps marketing book available in Amazon. If you have any specific questions, you can also tweet us using the hashtag AskPH. I'd be delighted to answer your questions. Until next week, goodbye.